Japan, where all the day's activities took place to the rhythm of bells, I automatically glanced at the window to gauge the intensity of the light and guess the time of day. Bright, clear light, and a window free of ice. The bells rang for the Angelus then, and it was noon. I stretched, enjoying the blissful knowledge that I needn't get up at once. Early pregnancy made me tired, and the strain of travel had added to my fatigue, making the long rest doubly welcome. It had rained and snowed unceasingly on the journey as the winter storms battered the French coast. Still, it could have been worse. We had originally intended to go to Rome, not Le Havre. That would have been 3 or 4 weeks' travel in this weather. Faced with the prospect of earning a living abroad, Jamie had obtained a recommendation as a translator to James Francis Edward Stuart, exiled King of Scotland, or merely the Chevalier St. George, pretender to the throne, depending on your loyalties, and we had determined to join the Pretender's Court near Rome. It had been a near thing at that. We had been on the point of leaving for Italy when Jamie's uncle Alexander, Abbot of St. Anne, had summoned us to his study.
"I've heard from His Majesty," he announced without preamble.
"Which one?" Jamie asked.
The slight family resemblance between the two men was exaggerated by their posture. Both sat bolt upright in their chairs, shoulders squared. On the abbot's part, the posture was due to natural asceticism. On Jamie's, to reluctance to let the newly healed scars on his back contact the wood of the chair.
"His Majesty King James," his uncle replied, frowning slightly at me.
I was careful to keep my face blank. My presence in Abbot Alexander's study was a mark of trust, and I didn't want to do anything to jeopardize it. He had known me a bare 6 weeks, since the day after Christmas, when I had appeared at his gate with Jamie, who was near death from torture and imprisonment. Subsequent acquaintance had presumably given the abbot some confidence in me. On the other hand, I was still English, and the English king's name was George, not James.
"Aye? Is he not in need of a translator, then?"
Jamie was still thin, but he had been working outdoors with the brothers who minded the stables and fields of the abbey, and his face was regaining tinges of its normal healthy colour.
"He is in need of a loyal servant and a friend."
Abbot Alexander tapped his fingers on a folded letter that lay on his desk, the crested seal broken. He pursed his lips, glancing from me to his nephew and back.
"What I tell you now must not be repeated," he said sternly. "It will be common knowledge soon. But for now..."
I had tried to look trustworthy and close-mouthed. Jamie merely nodded with a touch of impatience.
"His Highness Prince Charles Edward has left Rome and will arrive in France within the week," the abbot said, leaning slightly forward as though to emphasize the importance of what he was saying.
And it was important. James Stuart had mounted an abortive attempt to regain his throne in 1715, an ill-considered military operation that had failed almost immediately for lack of support. Since then, according to Alexander, the exiled James of Scotland had worked tirelessly, writing ceaselessly to his fellow monarchs, and particularly to his cousin Louis of France, reiterating the legitimacy of his claim to the throne of Scotland and England, and the position of his son, Prince Charles, as heir to that throne.
"His royal cousin Louis has been distressingly deaf to these entirely proper claims," the abbot had said, frowning at the letter as though it were Louis. "If he's now come to a realization of his responsibilities in the matter, it's cause for great rejoicing among those who hold dear the sacred right of kingship."
Among the Jacobites, that was, James' supporters, of whom Abbot Alexander of the Abbey of St. Anne, born Alexander Fraser of Scotland, was one. Jamie had told me that Alexander was one of the exiled king's most frequent correspondents, in touch with all that touched the Stuart cause.
"He's well placed for it,"
Jamie had explained to me, discussing the endeavour on which we were about to embark.
The people messenger system crosses Italy, France and Spain faster than almost any other, and the people messengers canna be interfered with by government customs officers, so the letters they carry are less likely to be intercepted.
James of Scotland, exiled in Rome, was supported in large part by the Pope, in whose interest it very much was to have a Catholic monarchy restored to England and Scotland. Therefore, the largest part of James' private mail was carried by papal messenger, and passed through the hands of loyal supporters within the church hierarchy, like Abbot Alexander of Santa Anne de Beaupré, who could be depended on to communicate with the king's supporters in Scotland with less risk than sending letters openly from Rome to Edinburgh and the Highlands. I watched Alexander with interest as he expounded the importance of Prince Charles' visit to France. A stocky man of about my own height, he was dark and considerably shorter than his nephew, but shared with him the faintly slanted eyes, the sharp intelligence, and the talent for discerning hidden motive that seemed to characterise the phrases I had met.
"So,"
he finished, stroking his full, dark brown beard,
"I cannot say whether His Highness is in France at Louis's invitation, or has come uninvited on behalf of his father."
"It makes a wee bit of difference," Jamie remarked, raising one eyebrow sceptically.
His uncle nodded, and a wry smile showed briefly in the thicket of his beard.
"True, lad," he said,
letting a faint hint of his native Scots emerge from his usual formal English.
"Very true. And that's where you and your wife may be of service, if you will."
The proposal was simple. His Majesty King James would provide travel expenses and a small stipend if the nephew of his most loyal and most esteemed friend Alexander would agree to travel to Paris, there to assist his son, His Highness Prince Charles Edward, in whatever ways the latter might require. I was stunned. We had meant originally to go to Rome, because that seemed the best place to embark on our quest, the prevention of the second Jacobite rising, the 45. From my own knowledge of history, I knew that the rising, financed from France and carried out by Charles Edward Stuart, would go much farther than had his father's attempt in 1715, but not nearly far enough. If matters progressed as I thought they would, then the troops under Bonnie Prince Charlie would meet with disastrous defeat at Culloden in 1746, and the people of the Highlands would suffer the repercussions of defeat for two centuries thereafter. Now, in 1744, apparently Charles himself was just beginning his search for support in France. Where better to try to stop a rebellion than at the side of its leader? I glanced at Jamie, who was looking over his uncle's shoulder at a small shrine set into the wall. His eyes rested on the gilded figure of Saint Anne herself, and the small sheaf of hothouse flowers laid at her feet, while his thoughts worked behind an expressionless face. At last he blinked once, and smiled at his uncle.
"Whatever assistance His Highness might require."
"Aye," he said quietly.
"I think I can do that."
"We'll go."
And we had. Instead of proceeding directly to Paris, though, we had come down the coast from Santa Anne to Le Havre to meet first with Jamie's cousin, Jared Fraser. A prosperous Scottish émigré, Jared was an importer of wines and spirits with a small warehouse and large townhouse in Paris, and a very large warehouse indeed here in Le Havre, where he had asked Jamie to meet him, when Jamie had written to say we were en route to Paris. Sufficiently rested by now, I was beginning to feel hungry. There was food on the table. Jamie must have told the chambermaid to bring it in while I slept. I had no dressing gown, but my heavy velvet travelling cloak was handy. I sat up and pulled the warm weight of it over my shoulders before rising to relieve myself, add another stick of wood to the fire, and sit down to my late breakfast. I chewed hard rolls and baked ham contentedly, washing them down with a jug of milk provided. I hoped Jamie was being adequately fed as well. He insisted that Jared was a good friend, but I had my doubts about the hospitality of some of Jamie's relatives, having met a few of them by now. True, Abbot Alexander had welcomed us, insofar as a man in the abbot's position could be said to welcome having an outlaw nephew with a suspect wife descend upon him unexpectedly. But our sojourn with Jamie's mother's people, the Mackenzies of Leoch, had come within inches of killing me the autumn before, when I had been arrested and tried as a witch.
"Granted," I'd said, "this Jared's a Fraser, and they seem a trifle safer than your Mackenzie relatives. But have you actually met him before?"
"I lived with him for a time when I was 18,"
he told me, dribbling candle wax onto his reply and pressing his father's wedding ring on the resultant greenish-grey puddle. A small cabochon ruby, its mount was engraved with the Fraser clan motto, "Je suis prêt." "I am ready."
"He had me to stay with him when I came to Paris to finish my schooling and learn a bit of the world. He was very kind to me, a good friend of my father's. And there's no one knows more about Parisian society than the man who sells it drink," he added, cracking the ring loose from the hardened wax. "I want to talk to Jared before I walk into Louis's court by the side of Charles Stuart. I should like to feel that I have some chance of getting out again,"
he finished wryly.
"Why? Do you think there'll be trouble?" I asked. "Whatever assistance His Highness might require seemed to offer quite a bit of latitude."
He smiled at my worried look.
"No, I didn't expect any difficulty. But what is it the Bible says, Sassenach? Put not your trust in princes."
He rose and kissed me quickly on the brow, tucking the ring back in his sporran.
"Who am I to ignore the word of God, eh?"
I spent the afternoon in reading one of the herbals that my friend Brother Ambrose had pressed upon me as a parting gift, then in necessary repairs with needle and thread. Neither of us owned many clothes, and while there were advantages in travelling light, it meant that holy socks and undone hems demanded immediate attention. My needle case was nearly as precious to me as the small chest in which I carried herbs and medicines. The needle dipped in and out of the fabric, winking in the light from the window. I wondered how Jamie's visit with Jared was going.
I wondered still more what Prince Charles would be like. He would be the first historically famous person I had met, and while I knew better than to believe all the legends that had, not had, would, I reminded myself, sprung up around him, the reality of the man was a mystery.
The rising of the 45 would depend almost entirely on the personality of this one young man, its failure or success. Whether it took place at all might depend upon the efforts of another young man, Jamie Fraser, and me. I was still absorbed in my mending and my thoughts when heavy footsteps in the corridor aroused me to the realization that it was late in the day. The drip of water from the eaves had slowed as the temperature dropped, and the flames of the sinking sun glowed in the ice spears hanging from the roof. The door opened, and Jamie came in. He smiled vaguely in my direction, then stopped dead by the table, face absorbed, as though he were trying to remember something. He took his cloak off, folded it, and hung it neatly over the foot of the bed, straightened, marched over to the other stool, sat down on it with great precision, and closed his eyes. I sat still, my mending forgotten in my lap, watching this performance with considerable interest. After a moment, he opened his eyes and smiled at me, but didn't say anything. He leaned forward, studying my face with great attention, as though he hadn't seen me in weeks. At last, an expression of profound revelation passed over his face, and he relaxed, shoulders slumping as he rested his elbows on his knees.
"Whiskey," he said,
with immense satisfaction. "I see," I said cautiously. "A lot of it." He shook his head slowly from side to side, as though it were very heavy. I could almost hear the contents sloshing.
"Not me,"
he said, very distinctly.
"You."
"Me?" I said indignantly.
"Your eyes,"
he said. He smiled beatifically. His own eyes were soft and dreamy, cloudy as a trout pool in the rain.
"My eyes? What have my eyes got to do with..."
"They're the colour of very fine whisky, with the sun shining through them from behind. I thought this morning they looked like sherry, but I was wrong. Not sherry, not brandy. It's whisky. That's what it is."
He looked so gratified as he said this that I couldn't help laughing.
"Jamie, you're terribly drunk. What have you been doing?"
His expression altered to a slight frown.
"I'm not drunk."
"Oh, no?"
I laid the mending aside and came over to lay a hand on his forehead. It was cool and damp, though his face was flushed. He at once put his arms about my waist and pulled me close, nuzzling affectionately at my bosom. The smell of mingled spirits rose from him like a fog, so thick as almost to be visible.
"Come here to me, Sassenach," he murmured. "My whisky-eyed lass, my love, let me take you to bed."
I thought it a debatable point as to who was likely to be taking whom to bed, but didn't argue.
It didn't matter why he thought he was going to bed, after all, provided he got there. I bent and got a shoulder under his armpit to help him up, but he leaned away, rising slowly and majestically under his own power.
"I dinna need help,"
he said, reaching for the cord at the neck of his shirt.
"I told you, I'm not drunk."
"You're right," I said. "Drunk isn't anywhere near sufficient to describe your current state. Jamie, you're completely pissed."
His eyes travelled down the front of his kilt, across the floor, and up the front of my gown.
"No, I'm not," he said, with great dignity. "I did that outside."
He took a step toward me, glowing with ardour.
"Come here to me, Sassenach. I'm ready."
I thought "ready" was a bit of an overstatement in one regard. He'd gotten his buttons half undone, and his shirt hung askew on his shoulders. But that was as far as he was likely to make it unaided. In other respects, though, the broad expanse of his chest was exposed, showing the small hollow in the centre where I was accustomed to rest my chin, and the small curly hairs sprang up joyous around his nipples. He saw me looking at him, and reached for one of my hands, clasping it to his breast. He was startlingly warm, and I moved instinctively toward him. The other arm swept round me, and he bent to kiss me. He made such a thorough job of it that I felt mildly intoxicated merely from sharing his breath.
"All right," I said, laughing. "If you're ready, so am I. Let me undress you first, though. I've had enough mending today."
He stood still as I stripped him, scarcely moving. He didn't move either as I attended to my own clothes and turned down the bed. I climbed in and turned to look at him, ruddy and magnificent in the sunset glow. He was finely made as a Greek statue, long-nosed and high-cheeked as a profile on a Roman coin. The wide, soft mouth was set in a dreamy smile, and the slanted eyes looked far away. He was perfectly immobile. I viewed him with some concern.
"Jamie," I said, "how exactly do you decide whether you're drunk?"
Aroused by my voice, he swayed alarmingly to one side, but caught himself on the edge of the mantelpiece. His eyes drifted around the room, then fixed on my face. For an instant they blazed, clear and pellucid with intelligence.
"Ugh, easy, Sassenach. If you can stand up, you're not drunk."
He let go of the mantelpiece and took a step toward me, and crumpled slowly onto the hearth, eyes blank, and a wide, sweet smile on his dreaming face.
"Oh," I said.
The yodeling of roosters outside and the clashing of pots below woke me just after dawn the next morning. The figure next to me jerked, waking abruptly, then froze as a sudden movement jarred his head. I raised up on one elbow to examine the remains. "Not too bad," I thought critically. His eyes were screwed tightly shut against stray beams of sunlight, and his hair stuck out in all directions like a hedgehog's spines. But his skin was pale and clear, and the hands clutching the coverlet were steady. I pried up one eyelid, peered within, and said playfully, "Anybody home?" The twin to the eye I was looking at opened slowly to add its baleful glare to the first. I dropped my hand and smiled charmingly at him. "Good morning."
"That, Sassenach, is entirely a matter of opinion," he said,
and closed both eyes again. "Have you got any idea how much you weigh?" I asked conversationally.
"No."
The abruptness of the reply suggested that he not only didn't know, he didn't care, but I persisted in my efforts. "Something around 15 stone, I make it. About as much as a good-sized boar. Unfortunately, I didn't have any beaters to hang you upside down from a spear and carry you home to the smoking shed." One eye opened again and looked consideringly at me, then at the hearthstone on the far side of the room. One corner of his mouth lifted in a reluctant smile.
"How did you get me in bed?"
"I didn't. I couldn't budge you. So I just laid a quilt over you and left you on the hearth. You came to life and crawled in under your own power somewhere in the middle of the night." He seemed surprised and opened the other eye again.
"I did."
I nodded and tried to smooth down the hair that spiked out over his left ear. "Oh, yes. Very single-minded you were."
"Single-minded?"
He frowned, thinking, and stretched, thrusting his arms up over his head. Then he looked startled.
"No, I couldn't have."
"Yes, you could. Twice." He squinted down his chest, as though looking for confirmation of this improbable statement, then looked back at me.
"Really? Well, that's hardly fair. I don't remember a thing about it."
He hesitated for a moment, looking shy.
"Was it all right, then? I didn't do anything foolish."
I flopped down next to him and snuggled my head into the curve of his shoulder. "No, I wouldn't call it foolish. You weren't very conversational, though."
"Thank the Lord for small blessings," he said,
and a small chuckle rumbled through his chest. You'd forgotten how to say anything except, "I love you." But you said that a lot. The chuckle came back, louder this time.
"Why? Well, could have been worse, I suppose."
He drew in his breath, then paused. He turned his head and sniffed suspiciously at the soft tuft of cinnamon under his raised arm.
"Christ," he said.
He tried to push me away.
"You dinna want to put your head near my oxter, Sassenach. I smell like a boar that's been dead a week."
"And pickled in brandy after," I agreed, snuggling closer. "How on earth did you get so, stinking drunk anyway?"
"Jared's hospitality."
He settled himself in the pillows with a deep sigh, arm round my shoulder.
"He took me down to show me his warehouse at the docks, and the storeroom there where he keeps the rare vintages and the Portuguese brandy and the Jamaican rum.
He grimaced slightly, recalling.
The wine wasn't so bad. For that you just teased and spit it on the floor when you're done with your mouthful. But neither of us could see wasting the brandy that way. Besides, Jared said you need to let it trickle down the back of your throat to appreciate it fully.
How much of it did you appreciate? I asked curiously.
I lost count in the middle of the second bottle.
Just then a church bell started to ring nearby, the summons to early mass. Jamie sat bolt upright, staring at the window pane, bright with sun.
Christ, Zasnach, what time is it?
About 6, I suppose, I said, puzzled.
Why?
He relaxed slightly, though he stayed sitting up.
Oh, that's all right then. I was afraid it was the Angelus bell. Had lost all track of time.
I'd say so. Does it matter? In a burst of energy, he threw back the quilts and stood up. He staggered a moment, but kept his balance, though both hands went to his head to make sure it was still attached.
"Aye," he said, gasping a bit. "We've an appointment this morning down at the docks at Jared's warehouse. The two of us."
"Really?" I clambered out of bed myself and groped for the chamber pot under the bed. If he's planning to finish the job, I shouldn't think he'd want witnesses. Jamie's head popped through the neck of his shirt, eyebrows raised.
"Finish the job?"
"Well, most of your other relatives seem to want to kill you, or me. Why not Jared? He's made a good start at poisoning you, seems to me."
"Very funny, Zasnach," he said dryly. "Have you something decent to wear?"
I'd been wearing a serviceable grey serge gown on our travels, acquired through the good offices of the almoner at the Abbey of Sainte Anne. But I did also have the gown in which I had escaped from Scotland, a gift from Lady Annabel MacRannoch. A pretty leaf-green velvet. It made me look rather pale, but was stylish enough. "I think so, if there aren't too many saltwater stains on it." I knelt by the small travelling chest, unfolding the green velvet. Kneeling next to me, Jamie flicked back the lid of my medicine box, studying the layers of bottles and boxes and bits of gauze-wrapped herbs.
"Have you got anything in here for a very vicious headache, Zasnach?"
I peered over his shoulder, then reached in and touched one bottle. Whorehound might help, though it's not the best. And willow bark tea with sow fennel works fairly well, but it takes some time to brew. Tell you what, why don't I make you up a recipe for hobnailed liver? Wonderful hangover cure. He bent a suspicious blue eye on me.
"That sounds nasty."
"It is," I said cheerfully, "but you'll feel lots better after you throw up."
"Mm-hmm."
He stood up and nudged the chamber pot toward me with one toe.
"Vomiting in the morning is your job, Zasnach," he said. "Get it over with and get dressed. I'll stand the headache."
Jared Monroe Fraser was a small, spare, black-eyed man who bore more than a passing resemblance to his distant cousin, Myrtle, the Fraser clansman who had accompanied us to Le Havre. When I first saw Jared, standing majestically in the gaping doors of his warehouse so that streams of longshoremen carrying casks were forced to go around him, the resemblance was strong enough that I blinked and rubbed my eyes. Myrtle, so far as I knew, was still at the inn attending a lame horse. Jared had the same lank, dark hair and piercing eyes, the same sinewy, monkey-like frame. But there, all resemblance stopped, and as we drew closer, Jamie gallantly clearing a path for me through the mob with elbows and shoulders, I could see the differences as well. Jared's face was oblong rather than hatchet-shaped, with a cheerful snub nose that effectively ruined the dignified air conferred at a distance by his excellent tailoring and upright carriage. A successful merchant rather than a cattle raider, he also knew how to smile, unlike Myrtle, whose natural expression was one of unrelieved dourness. and a broad grin of welcome broke out on his face as we were jostled and shoved up the ramp into his presence.
"My dear!" he exclaimed, clutching me by the arm and yanking me deftly out of the way of two burly stevedores rolling a gigantic cask through the huge door. "So pleased to see you at last!"
The cask bumped noisily on the boards of the ramp, and I could hear the rolling slosh of its contents as it passed me.
"You can treat rum like that," Jared observed, watching the ungainly progress of the enormous barrel through the obstructions of the warehouse, but not port. I always fetch that up myself, along with the bottled wines. In fact, I was just setting off to see to a new shipment of Belle Rouge port. Would you perhaps be interested in accompanying me?"
I glanced at Jamie, who nodded, and we set off at once in Jared's wake, sidestepping the rumbling traffic of casks and hogsheads, carts and barrows, and men and boys of all descriptions carrying bolts of fabric, boxes of grain and foodstuffs, rolls of hammered copper, sacks of flour, and anything else that could be transported by ship. Le Havre was an important centre of shipping traffic, and the docks were the heart of the city. A long, solid wharf ran nearly a quarter mile round the edge of the harbour, with smaller docks protruding from it, along which were anchored free-masted barques and brigantines, dories and small galleys, a full range of the ships that provisioned France. Jamie kept a firm hold on my elbow, the better to yank me out of the way of oncoming handcarts, rolling casks, and careless merchants and seamen, who were inclined not to look where they were going, but rather to depend on sheer momentum to see them through the scrum of the docks. As we made our way down the quay, Jared shouted genteelly into my ear on the other side, pointing out objects of interest as we passed, and explaining the history and ownership of the various ships in a staccato, disjointed manner. The Ariana, which we were on our way to see, was in fact one of Jared's own ships. Ships, I gathered, might belong to a single owner, more often to a company of merchants who owned them collectively, or, occasionally, to a captain who contracted his vessel, crew, and services for a voyage. Seeing the number of company-owned vessels, compared to the relatively few owned by individuals, I began to form a very respectful idea of Jared's worth. The Ariana was in the middle of an anchored row, near a large warehouse with the name Fraser painted on it in sloping, whitewashed letters. Seeing the name gave me an odd little thrill, a sudden feeling of alliance and belonging, with the realization that I shared that name, and with it, an acknowledged kinship with those who bore it. The Ariana was a three-masted ship, perhaps 60 feet long, with a wide bow. There were two cannon on the side of the ship that faced the dock, in case of robbery on the high seas, I supposed. Men were swarming all over the deck with what I assumed was some purpose, though it looked like nothing so much as an ant's nest under attack. All sails were reefed and tied, but the rising tide shifted the vessel slightly, swinging the bowsprit toward us. It was decorated with a rather grim-visaged figurehead, with her formidable bare bosom and tangled curls all spangled with salt. The lady looked as though she didn't enjoy sea air all that much.
"Sweet little beauty, is she not?" Jared asked, waving a hand expansively.
I assumed he meant the ship, not the figurehead.
"Very nice," said Jamie politely.
I caught his uneasy glance at the boat's waterline, where the small waves lapped dark grey against the hull. I could see that he was hoping we wouldn't be obliged to go on board. A gallant warrior, brilliant, bold, and courageous in battle, Jamie Fraser was also a landlubber. Definitely not one of the hardy, seafaring Scots who hunted whales from Tarwathy, or voyage the world in search of wealth. He suffered from a seasickness so acute that our journey across the Channel in December had nearly killed him, weakened as he was then by the effects of torture and imprisonment. And while yesterday's drinking orgy with Jared wasn't in the same league,
it wasn't likely to have made him any more seaworthy. I could see dark memories crossing his face as he listened to his cousin extolling the sturdiness and speed of the Ariana, and drew near enough to whisper to him. "Surely not while it's at anchor."
"I don't know, Sassenach,"
he replied, with a look at the ship in which loathing and resignation were nicely mingled.
"But I suppose we'll find out."
Jared was already halfway up the gangplank, greeting the captain with loud cries of welcome.
"If I turn green, can you pretend to faint or something? It will make a poor impression if I vomit on Jared's shoes."
I patted his arm reassuringly.
"Don't worry, I have faith in you." "But isn't it me?"
he said, with a last lingering glance at terra firma.
"It's my stomach."
The ship stayed comfortingly level under our shoes, however, and both Jamie and his stomach acquitted themselves nobly, assisted perhaps by the brandy poured out for us by the captain.
"A nice make,"
Jamie said, passing the glass briefly under his nose and closing his eyes in approval of the rich aromatic fumes.
"Portuguese, isn't it?"
Jared laughed delightedly and nudged the captain.
"You see, Portus, I told you he had a natural palate. He's only tasted it once before."
I bit the inside of my cheek and avoided Jamie's eye. The captain, a large, scruffy-looking specimen, looked bored, but grimaced politely in Jamie's direction, exhibiting 3 gold teeth. A man who liked to keep his wealth portable.
"Ah," he said, "this the lad's going to keep your bilges dry, is it?"
Jared looked suddenly embarrassed, a slight flush rising under the leathery skin of his face. I noticed with fascination that one ear was pierced for an earring, and wondered just what sort of background had led to his present success.
"Aye, well," he said, betraying for the first time a hint of Scots accent. "That's to be seen yet. But I think,"
he glanced to the port at the activity taking place on the dock, then back at the captain's glass, drained in 3 gulps while the rest of us were sipping.
"I say, Portis, would you allow me to use your cabin for a moment? I should like to confer with my nephew and his wife, and I see that the aft hold seems to be having a bit of trouble with the cargo nets from the sound of it."
This craftily added observation was enough to send Captain Portis out of the cabin like a charging boar, hoarse voice uplifted in a Spanish-French patois that I, luckily, didn't understand. Jared stepped delicately to the door and closed it firmly after the captain's bulky form, cutting down the noise level substantially. He returned to the tiny captain's table and ceremoniously refilled all our glasses before speaking. Then he looked from Jamie to me and smiled once more in charming deprecation.
"It's a bit more precipitous than I'd meant to make such a request," he said. "But I see the good captain has rather given away my hand. The truth of the matter is..."
He raised his glass so the watery reflections from the port shivered through the brandy, striking patches of wavering light from the brass fittings of the cabin.
"I need a man."
He tipped the cup in Jamie's direction, then brought it to his lips and drank.
"A good man,"
he amplified, lowering the glass.
"You see, my dear," bowing to me, "I have the opportunity of making an exceptional investment in a new winery in the Moselle region. But the evaluation of it is not one I should feel comfortable in entrusting to a subordinate. I should need to see the facilities myself and advise in their development. The undertaking would require several months."
He gazed thoughtfully into his glass, gently swirling the fragrant brown liquid so its perfume filled the tiny cabin. I had drunk no more than a few sips from my own glass, but began to feel slightly giddy, more from a rising excitement than from drink.
"It's too good a chance to be missed," Jared said. "And there's the chance of making several good contacts with the wineries along the Rhone.
The products there are excellent, but relatively rare in Paris. God, they'd sell among the nobility like snow in summer.
His shrewd black eyes gleamed momentarily with visions of avarice, then sparkled with humour as he looked at me.
But, he said, but, I finished for him, you can't leave your business here without a guiding hand. Intelligence as well as beauty and charm. I congratulate you, cousin.
He tilted a well-groomed head toward Jamie, one eyebrow cocked in humorous approval.
I confess that I was at something of a loss to see how I was to proceed, he said,
setting the glass down on the small table with the air of a man putting aside social frivolity for the sake of serious business.
But when you wrote from Santa Anne saying you intended to visit Paris...
He hesitated a moment, then smiled at Jamie with an odd little flutter of the hands.
Knowing that you, my lad, he nodded to Jamie, have a head for figures, I was strongly inclined to consider your arrival an answer to prayer. Still, I thought that perhaps we should meet and become reacquainted before I took the step of making you a definite proposal.
You mean you thought you'd better see how presentable I was? I thought cynically, but smiled at him nonetheless. I caught Jamie's eye, and one of his brows twitched upward. This was our week for proposals, evidently. For a dispossessed outlaw and a suspected English spy, our services seemed to be rather in demand. Jarrod's proposal was more than generous. In return for Jamie's running the French end of the business during the next 6 months, Jarrod would not only pay him a salary, but would leave his Paris townhouse, complete with staff, at our disposal.
"Not at all, not at all," he said, when Jamie tried to protest this provision.
He pressed a finger on the end of his nose, grinning charmingly at me.
"A pretty woman to host dinner parties is a great asset in the wine business, cousin. You have no idea how much wine you can sell if you let the customers taste it first."
He shook his head decidedly.
"Nope. It will be a great service to me if your wife would allow herself to be troubled by entertaining."
The thought of hosting supper parties of Parisian society was, in fact, a trifle daunting. Jamie looked at me, eyebrows raised in question. But I swallowed hard and smiled, nodding. It was a good offer. If he felt competent to take over the running of an importing business, the least I could do was order dinner and brush up my sprightly conversational French.
"Not at all," I murmured.
But Jarrod had taken my agreement for granted, and was going on, intent black eyes fixed on Jamie.
"And then I thought perhaps you'd be needing an establishment of sorts, for the benefit of the other interests which bring you to Paris."
Jamie smiled non-committally, at which Jarrod uttered a short laugh and picked up his brandy glass. We had each been provided a glass of water as well, for cleansing the palate between sips, and he pulled one of these close with the other hand.
"Well, a toast," he exclaimed, "to our association cousin, and to His Majesty."
He lifted the brandy glass in salute, then passed it ostentatiously over the glass of water, and brought it to his lips. I watched this odd behaviour in surprise, but it apparently meant something to Jamie, for he smiled at Jarrod, picked up his own glass, and passed it over the water.
"To His Majesty," he repeated.
Then, seeing me staring at him in bewilderment, he smiled and explained.
"To His Majesty, over the water, Sassnach."
"Oh?" I said. Then, realization dawning, "Oh, the king over the water, King James,"
which did a bit to explain this sudden urge on the part of everyone to see Jamie and myself established in Paris, which would otherwise have seemed an improbable coincidence.
If Jarrod were also a Jacobite, then his correspondence with the Abbot Alexander was very likely more than coincidental. Chances were that Jamie's letter announcing our arrival had come together with one from Alexander, explaining the commission from King James. And if our presence in Paris fitted in with Jared's own plans, then so much the better. With a sudden appreciation for the complexities of the Jacobite network, I raised my own glass and drank to His Majesty across the water and our new partnership with Jared. Jared and Jamie then settled down to a discussion of the business and were soon head to head, bent over inky sheets of paper, evidently manifests and bills of lading. The tiny cabin reeked of tobacco, brandy fumes, and unwashed sailor, and I began to feel a trifle queasy again. Seeing that I wouldn't be needed for a while, I stood up quietly and found my way out on deck. I was careful to avoid the altercation still going on around the rear cargo hatch, and picked my way through coils of rope, object which I assumed to be belaying pins, and tumbled piles of sail fabric, to a quiet spot in the bow. From here, I had an unobstructed view over the harbour. I sat on a chest against the taffrail, enjoying the salty breeze and the tarry, fishy smells of ships and harbour. It was still cold, but with my cloak pulled tight around me, I was warm enough. The ship rocked slowly, rising on the incoming tide. I could see the beards of algae on nearby dock pilings lifting and swirling, obscuring the shiny black patches of mussels between them. The thought of mussels reminded me of the steamed mussels with butter I had had for dinner the night before, and I was suddenly starving. The absurd contrasts of pregnancy seemed to keep me always conscious of my digestion. If I wasn't vomiting, I was ravenously hungry. The thought of food led me to the thought of menus, which led me back to a contemplation of the entertaining Jared had mentioned. Dinner parties, hmm? It seemed an odd way to begin the job of saving Scotland, but then I couldn't really think of anything better. At least if I had Charles Stuart across a dinner table from me, I could keep an eye on him, I thought, smiling to myself at the joke. If he showed signs of hopping a ship for Scotland, maybe I could slip something into his soup. Perhaps that wasn't so funny after all. The thought reminded me of Gillis Duncan, and my smile faded. Wife of the procurator fiscal in Cranesmere, she had murdered her husband by dropping powdered cyanide into his food at a banquet. Accused as a witch soon afterward, she had been arrested while I was with her, and I had been taken to trial myself. A trial from which Jamie had rescued me. The memories of several days spent in the cold dark of the thieves' hole at Cranesmere were all too fresh, and the wind seemed suddenly very cold. I shivered, but not altogether from chill. I couldn't think of Gillis Duncan without that cold finger down my spine. Not so much because of what she had done, but because of who she had been. A Jacobite, too. One whose support of the Stuart cause had been more than slightly tinged with madness. Worse than that, she was what I was, a traveller through the standing stones. I didn't know whether she had come to the past as I had by accident, or whether her journey had been deliberate. Neither did I know precisely where she had come from. But my last vision of her, screaming defiance at the judges who would condemn her to burn, was of a tall, fair woman, arms stretched high, showing on one arm the telltale round of a vaccination scar. I felt automatically for the small patch of roughened skin on my own upper arm, beneath the comforting folds of my cloak, and shuddered when I found it. I was distracted from these unhappy memories by a growing commotion on the next quay. A large knot of men had gathered by a ship's gangway, and there was considerable shouting and pushing going on. Not a fight. I peered over at the altercation, shading my eyes with my hand, but could see no blows exchanged. Instead, an effort seemed to be underway to clear a pathway through the milling crowd to the doors of a large warehouse on the upper end of the quay. The crowd was stubbornly resisting all such efforts, surging back like the tide after each push. Jamie suddenly appeared behind me, closely followed by Jared, who squinted at the mob scene below. Absorbed by the shouting, I hadn't heard them come up.
"What is it?"
I stood and leaned back into Jamie, bracing myself against the increasing sway of the ship underfoot. I was aware at close quarters of his scent. He had bathed at the inn, and he smelled clean and warm with a faint hint of sun and dust. A sharpening of the sense of smell was another effect of pregnancy, apparently. I could smell him even among the myriad stenches and scents of the seaport, much as you can hear a low-pitched voice close by in a noisy crowd. I don't know. Some trouble with the other ship, looks like. He reached down and put a hand on my elbow to steady me. Jared turned and barked an order in guttural French to one of the sailors nearby. The man promptly hopped over the rail and slid down one of the ropes to the quay, tarred pigtail dangling toward the water. We watched from the deck as he joined the crowd, prodded another seaman in the ribs, and received an answer, complete with expressive gesticulations. Jared was frowning as the pigtailed man scrambled back up the crowded gangplank. The sailor said something to him in that same thick-sounding French, too fast for me to follow it. After a few more words conversation, Jared swung abruptly around and came to stand next to me, lean hands gripping the rail.
"He says there's sickness aboard the Patagonia."
"What sort of sickness?" I hadn't thought of bringing my medicine box with me, so there was little I could do in any case. But I was curious. Jared looked worried and unhappy.
"They're afraid it might be smallpox, but they don't know. The port's inspector and the harbour master have been called."
"Would you like me to have a look?" I offered.
"I might at least be able to tell you whether it's a contagious disease or not."
Jared's sketchy eyebrows disappeared under the lank black fringe of his hair. Jamie looked mildly embarrassed.
"My wife's well known as a healer, cousin," he explained,
but then turned and shook his head at me.
"No, Sassenach, it wouldna be safe."
I could see the Patagonia's gangway easily. Now the gathered crowd moved suddenly back, jostling and stepping on each other's toes. Two seamen stepped down from the deck, a length of canvas slung between them as a stretcher. The white sail fabric sagged heavily under the weight of the man they carried, and a bare, sun-darkened arm lolled from the makeshift hammock. The seamen wore strips of cloth tied round their noses and mouths, and kept their faces turned away from the stretcher, jerking their heads as they growled at each other, manoeuvring their burden over the splintered planks. The pair passed under the fascinated noses of the crowd and disappeared into a nearby warehouse. Making a quick decision, I turned and headed for the rear gangplank of the Ariana.
"Don't worry," I called to Jamie over one shoulder. "If it's smallpox, I can't get that."
One of the seamen, hearing me, paused and gaped, but I just smiled at him and brushed past. The crowd was still now, no longer surging to and fro, and it wasn't so difficult to make my way between the muttering clusters of seamen, many of whom frowned or looked startled as I ducked past them. The warehouse was disused. No bales or casks filled the echoing shadows of the huge room, but the scents of sawn lumber, smoked meat and fish lingered, easily distinguishable from the host of other smells. The sick man had been hastily dumped near the door on a pile of discarded straw packing. His attendants pushed past me as I entered, eager to get away. I approached him cautiously, stopping a few feet away. He was flushed with fever, his skin a queer dark red, scabbed thick with white pustules. He moaned and tossed his head restlessly from side to side, cracked mouth working as though in search of water.
"Get me some water," I said to one of the sailors standing nearby.
The man,
a short, muscular fellow with his beard tarred into ornamental spikes, merely stared as though he had found himself suddenly addressed by a fish. Turning my back on him impatiently, I sank to my knees by the sick man and opened his filthy shirt. He stank abominably. Probably none too clean to start with, he had been left to lie in his own filth, his fellows afraid to touch him. His arms were relatively clear, but the pustules clustered thickly down his chest and stomach, and his skin was burning to the touch. Jamie had come in while I made my examination, accompanied by Jared. With them was a small, pear-shaped man in a gold-swagged official's coat, and two other men, one a nobleman, or a rich bourgeois by his dress, the other a tall, lean individual, clearly a seafarer from his complexion. Probably the captain of the plague ship, if that's what it was. And that's what it appeared to be. I had seen smallpox many times before in the uncivilized parts of the world, to which my Uncle Lamb, an eminent archaeologist, had taken me during my early years. This fellow wasn't pissing blood, as sometimes happened when the disease attacked the kidneys, but otherwise he had every classic symptom. "I'm afraid it is smallpox," I said. The Patagonia's captain gave a sudden howl of anguish and stepped toward me, face contorted, raising his hand as though to strike me. "No!" he shouted. "Fool of a woman! Salope! Femme sans cervelle! Do you want to ruin me?" The last word was cut off in a gurgle as Jamie's hand closed on his throat. The other hand twisted hard in the man's shirt front, lifting him onto his toes. "I should prefer you to address my wife with respect, monsieur," Jamie said, rather mildly. The captain, face turning purple, managed a short, jerky nod, and Jamie dropped him. He took a step back, wheezing, and sidled behind his companion as though for refuge, rubbing his throat. The tubby little official was bending cautiously over the sick man, holding a large silver pomander on a chain close to his nose as he did so. Outside, the level of noise dropped suddenly as the crowd pulled back from the warehouse doors to admit another canvas stretcher. The man before us sat up suddenly, startling the little official so that he nearly fell over. The man stared wildly around the warehouse, then his eyes rolled back in his head, and he fell back onto the straw as though he'd been poleaxed. He hadn't, but the end result was much the same. "He's dead," I said unnecessarily. The official, recovering his dignity along with his pomander, stepped in once more, looked closely at the body, straightened up, and announced, "Smallpox, the lady is correct. I'm sorry, Monsieur le Comte, but you know the law as well as anyone." The man he addressed sighed impatiently. He glanced at me, frowning, then jerked his head at the official. "I'm sure this can be arranged, Monsieur Bumblemousse. Please, a moment's private conversation." He motioned toward the deserted foreman's hut that stood some distance away, a small derelict structure inside the larger building. A nobleman by dress as well as by title, Monsieur le Comte was a slender, elegant sort, with heavy brows and thin lips. His entire attitude proclaimed that he was used to getting his way. But the little official was backing away, hands held out before him as though in self-defense. "Monsieur le Comte," he said, "je le regrette, mais c'est impossible. It cannot be done. Too many people know about it already. The news will be all over the docks by now." He glanced helplessly at Jamie and Jared, then waved vaguely at the warehouse door where the featureless heads of spectators showed in silhouette, the late afternoon sun rimming them with gold halos. "No," he said again, his pudgy features hardening with resolve. "You will excuse me, monsieur, and madame," he added belatedly, as though noticing me for the first time. "I must go and institute proceedings for the destruction of the ship." The captain uttered another choked howl at this,
and clutched at his sleeve, but he pulled away and hurried out of the building. The atmosphere following his departure was